Good morning. Welcome for our meeting. It's 9 a.m. on November 19, 2024, and plan to reconvene our regular meeting of the Snohomish County Beauty Board of Commissioners. I'm Sid Logan, President of the Commission. Joining me today are Commissioners Tony Olson and Rebecca Wolf, John Harlow, our CEO, Colin Wilbrock, our Chief Legal Officer, Allison Morrison, Clerk of the Board, Jenny Rich, and Morgan Stolzner, Deputy Clerks of the Board. Please mute or turn off your cell phones or electronic devices at this time. This session is for the board and the general manager to study and discuss issues among ourselves and with PUD staff. So our next agenda item is item two, our CEO general manager briefing and study session. Good morning, John.
Good morning, commissioners.
Good morning.
First up, as you noticed in your packet, we had the strategic plan quarterly update, and Laura Lemke is on the line virtually to answer any questions or have any discussions that you, any of you would like to have.
Morning, Laura.
Any questions on them?
I don't. I know that we're going to have a slightly different format and presentation as we move into 2025. So I have no questions on this report. Later at the end, by the way.
We're not having a presentation.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We don't need to have one. No. That's correct, right?
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. We, Commissioner Wolston wants a presentation. Is that correct? Well, when are we going to have
at least?
Not at all.
The next one will be after the first of the year.
Oh.
I think we had agreed, based on your feedback, that you continue to receive these quarterly, but then the board would only present, formally present on them twice a year.
That's right. Okay, so is it possible to ask a question?
Oh, yes, that's
what we're first of all, I value and appreciate all the metrics. But my question today has to do with the strategic objectives and the five priorities. I studied these quite carefully and I've given a lot of thought to them. So I guess my question is, so all of these officers of the different departments, energy, finance, customer service, information, communications, general counsel, or chief legal officer, all of these people are heads of departments, right?
Yeah. Are you talking about the chief positions?
The people who are named as officers.
Yes.
They are heads of those departments. Is that right?
Well, they are actually, they make up the executive team.
Pardon?
They make up the executive team.
Okay.
So they're heads of divisions or the specific work groups.
Okay. So, except Martin Fleury is manager, senior manager, P&D and so forth. Okay, my question is Laura on?
Yes.
Well, okay, Laura, so. You're a good thinker. You've done a ton of work. How do you view the commission? Is it a department? No matter who it is our leader, the person who kind of runs the commission, is that person kind of parallel to or equivalent to an officer?
Commissioner, I don't think that's relevant to this presentation. These are the list, these are the person who's responsible for each one of these priorities. They're the ones that's the lead on it.
I know that. But
how does your
to
question,
me, there's a big...
your question?
Because I'm interested to know if the commission could be at some point regarded as part of our strategic objectives in reaching our goals. Because if you look at the... Okay, an increasingly complex energy future. It seems to me that the commission as an office has to approve those, and some of these others do not directly relate. But certainly 2.1, working center our work around customer desires, challenges, and expectations. And our commission is part of that objective. I think, you know, if it's not appropriate, I will back off.
Well, I understand.
It's something that I've...
You've raised this.
I have wondered about how we, as a commission, and whoever the person is who runs the commission, seems to, I just want the commission to be highly respected and have our authority respected, and have whoever is responsible for all the work. There's just so much work that gets done in our, for our commission. So much work.
And you mean in terms of operation?
Yes, all the things that they do for us that relate, I mean, they're the ones that receive all of the accolades and complaints and letters and all of that from the public. So that definitely relates to centering our work around customer desires, challenges, and expectations in a way. And so strengthening our community connections, I think our board and the person who has the responsibility for running the board, it's very vitally, it seems to me, but you know, I'm at fault for, I'm always trying to make connections, see how things connect.
I can appreciate you.
As a learner and as a teacher, how do things connect? And so if they don't, then I will try to understand that too. So I guess I'm seeking to understand.
Well, we've had a discussion in our governance policy retreats. And certainly, I believe we're going to have another retreat next year. It has always been my understanding that the board's governance policy direction establishes, sets the umbrella for what you're seeing here in terms of the strategic objectives. And the reason that we don't oversee specific objectives is because that's operations. And the way our structure is the board is sets the policy, sets, you know, we want this accomplished as a utility from a policy standpoint. And then the way our governance policies are structured, then we have delegated to the general manager the authority to run the utility. From my perspective, that includes ensuring that operationally the strategic direction falls under the board approved policies, governance policies. Now, I tend to get off base a lot, but I do recall we have discussed this, and perhaps the clerk could add this to as an item to our, I'll leave it to the president, because Mr. President, it's your call.
Of course, that's for our next workshop.
Yeah,
no, that's the natural. I mean, this is one of the biggest challenges, and it's not just our board policies, it's also the RCW. The RCW directs the commission to hire a general manager to operate the utility.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so.
But I believe in regard to this document, you know, we did have a lot of input into these priorities. We approved these priorities. We could have altered, I think we could have had a conversation with our general manager if we had strong concern about the priorities. But to me, these are the specific leaders who are responsible for each one of these objectives. We're responsible, and John is also responsible for everything that happens here.
Yeah,
good or bad.
Let me take a stab at this, because I think I understand where you're going. So from an
may I just say, in response to, that's very helpful, everything you said. And I do understand that we operate under those policies. So the only related question in my mind is, when we hire personnel for the board, should the board not be somehow involved?
And you're talking about the clerk's office?
No, our staff, or the commission staff.
Well,
that's our staff.
Yeah, but now we're way off topic. That has nothing to do with this document. We need to stick to the topic.
Okay.
We're loosely at the topic now.
And I do think we'll have a new seated board. And I do think it's appropriate that we revisit, reassess, but are the underpinning of the board's adopted governance model delegates to the general manager, as does RCW, the ability to run the utility. And I guess there could be many different definitions of that. And I look forward to a discussion on it, to revisit things, and I'm totally open to it. But you know, I'll get cranky. Pardon? You know, I'll get cranky.
I value everything I've heard. You were going to speak.
I was just going to say, from an authoritative or authority, credibility, and respect standpoint, you all, the board, did approve the strategic plan and the overall strategic priorities for the organization. These are strategic objectives, basically the initiatives for us to execute on that plan. So you do have, on behalf of our customers that you represent, overall authority and responsibility. And what comes with that is the credibility for how well we execute on this plan.
I thank you for your patience.
And thank you for reminding us. I think it'll be a good discussion to have. Okay.
Anything else on the strategic plan, Commission?
I have nothing.
All right. Okay. Thank you, Lord.
Next
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right. Laura, were you going to say something?
No, I just said thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Laura. Next up, under other, I want to invite Clark Lanzarette to come up and have him talk a little bit about, and as you've seen in the packet, the Howard Transformer contract is in for approval. And that's been a little bit of an unusual contract renewal and or process for us to get in place. So I just wanted to have Clark kind of touch on some of the dynamics to give you a little bit more intel ahead of your potential approval of that contract. So, Clark, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, John. Good morning, Commissioners. Clark Lanzarette, Contracts and Purchasing. Like John said, this is a little unusual. I think what you're used to seeing in the consent agenda for what we call a material purchase.
Excuse me, so is that microphone on?
Oh, maybe I can stand a little closer.
Well, you're pretty close, but I can't tell if it's on. Is that right?
Sounds like it.
Okay.
I can hear it.
It's just me. Sorry, Clark.
So like John said, this is a little unusual. Normally we come back on an annual basis for material contracts to do renewals. And in the case of transformers, it doesn't make sense to do an annual renewal because when we order transformers now from our current vendor, it takes 18 to 24 months to receive those transformers. So the lead time is longer than the actual contract extension term would be. Also in our discussions with Howard, who has been our longtime vendor for distribution transformers. They were looking for some certainty of a longer term extension because they've been engaged in a lot of upgrades to their manufacturing capabilities to meet the increase in demand for transformers. And they the DOE requirements are changing in a couple of years. And that requires a lot of redesign. They say they're going to do as many as 10,000 redesigns. Drawings and redesign for the DOE. So they want some certainty for that too, that we're going to be with them in some fashion for a longer period of time. So we settled on an extension through the end of 2030. We did though have some concerns about those long lead times and not being able to mitigate those post-COVID. So we didn't want to put all our eggs in one basket, so to speak. We wanted to diversify the supply chain for distribution transformers. And to do that, we needed to renegotiate the terms of the contract so that Howard had a set amount that was smaller than the 100% that we had before with them. And so we settled on a negotiation, 55% with Howard. And that gives 55% of our annual requirements for the term through 2030. So we'll be placing orders for a minimum of 55% of our transformers during that time from Howard, and we will be looking for other suppliers to enter into
an equipment purchase. You know, we only pay for
one. Correct. And then we'd be looking for other manufacturers. The market has loosened up to where there is long-term capacity from other manufacturers out there, where it hasn't been for, say, the last 4 or 5 years. And so we're trying to take advantage of that and not be beholden to one supplier for those really critical pieces of equipment. So what you see in front of you is fairly unusual. It's a longer extension. The price tag on this at $68 million over that 6 years and 1 month is what it will end up being is higher generally than what you see. Just wanted to provide that context. Like John said, that this is an unusual. I'll give you the opportunity to digest that rather than just put it on the consent agenda and hope for the best.
Questions?
No, I hope for the best.
Thank
you. Yeah. In negotiating 30 years, is there some kind of a scale in terms of annual escalation in unit prices?
So that it's through 2030, 7 year term. And what we've had in place with Howard is unchanged, where on a quarterly basis, they provide us with an index based on their materials and the composition of the transformers that we order. So the prices are updated every quarter.
Oh, okay.
So is this a sole source contract or is this a contract that was bid at one time and has the extensions allowed in
it? Correct. It was bid and awarded in 2021. And we've extended it on for three 1 year terms since then. And like I said at the beginning, to extend it for just another year would be that'd be practical.
So I was recently in an APP policymakers meeting and a utility claimed that they'd had a very long standing relationship with one supplier. They had had no problems getting transformers. And so it just was an interesting thing. I just figured all suppliers, there's not necessarily a loyalty to an organization. It's this sort of unique thing in this industry where they tend to take care of their long-standing customers and if it's not appropriate, don't respond.
Yeah. Trying to think of exactly how to respond to that. You threw me a little bit with a utility that hasn't had any trouble getting transformers for a long time. That's sort of outside of my experience.
Yeah.
The answer in general is yes. When we saw that through COVID, where organizations were unable to order from suppliers that they didn't have a current relationship with, and generally that if you had a contract with a utility, even though they had constrained supply chains for their raw materials, they prioritized customers that they had contracts with and longer relationships with. And I think that that plays out still post-COVID.
Absolutely. Okay, thank you. Any other questions?
I do have one. So are these produced within the US?
Yes, they do most of the manufacturing and assembly in Mississippi.
Any other questions? Followed?
No, I don't. It's sometimes, you know, one might be concerned with an ongoing multi-year, but these vendors, you know, are utility, and I think that's a very great benefit to us, rather than starting with something new.
Yeah, this has been a crunch point with us for the last few years.
Oh, yeah.
Still affects how we do things. So,
and I will just say, Clark, being extremely humble, he and the team did a lot of work and got this contract landed in a very, very good place, very good place from where it started. And what I would say, the leverage that Howard tried to put on us, you know, given the current supply chain around transformers, and again, we landed, Clark and the team landed this in a very good place for us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Clark. Okay, next up is our continuation of our cost of service analysis and revenue adjustments or potential revenue adjustments. And it will be Peter Donhauer and Christina Langweber who will be presenting. Good morning, Peter, Christina.
Good morning. Good morning, Commissioners. Peter Donhauer, Senior Manager of Rates, Economics, Energy Risk Management. I'll be joined throughout the presentation by Christina Leineweber, our rates expert here at the PD. And so this is the second part of our presentation around this subject. A couple of weeks ago, we had some discussion around the theory. We're going to cover a little bit of that theory again. So we will address that at a high level, I would say, and going to be presenting the preliminary recommendation for the revenue adjustment. So the purpose of this presentation is to present our adjustment options based off of the cost of service analysis, also called the COSA, and for the 2025-2029 budget and forecast that we got. This is information only. We'll be coming back later for approvals after we've had thorough time to discuss. Our agenda is, as I said, to kind of talk a bit about the theory of the COSA. Then we're going to go into our rates recommendation, and we have some subjects around individual class adjustments for the residential class. And then we'll talk next steps very briefly at the end. So here we are in the middle of those bullet points. This is just a timeline for our past meetings and upcoming meetings. We do have one more briefing style meeting coming up in a couple of weeks with the intention then to have the open the public hearing on December 17th and then asking for commission approval on the first meeting in January. And so I'm going to hand it over to Christina to talk a bit about the theory, and then we'll get into the recommendation.
Good morning. Thank you for joining me again today here with a brief recapitulation of some of the material from the last COSA presentation, and then the recommendation from the rates group and the executive leadership team here at the utility. So as a brief reminder and recapitulation of where we are in this process, at the last meeting, we discussed the revenue requirement and how that sets the size and total amount of revenue that we need to collect from our retail rates, and that's our first step. And then we move into the cost of service analysis, which asks the question, who caused those costs? And therefore, how much should each of the classes bear of those costs? We did have some questions about the cost of service from the last time in the three phases of functionalization, classification, and allocation of those costs. And therefore, I'd like to present another example of the COSA and how those costs actually flow through on maybe a little more detailed level so everyone is on the same page about how this works. So I selected a line item from the cost of service, and these are actual numbers from this year's analysis for the operation of overhead distribution lines. So the functionalization is right there in the name. It did not take very much thought to think how you should functionalize this one. The distribution line should be functionalized as the distribution system. The next step then is classification, which is looking at what's driving that cost. And we divided up roughly 60-30, saying that there is some cost that's based on a customer count basis, on just the existence of a customer. No matter, before they even turn on the first switch, use the first kilowatt hour of electricity, there's some cost to get them hooked up to the system. And there's also, though, a bigger share of the cost. That's the 37% there. But a bigger chunk of the cost is caused by how much they're using. So if you use a lot, you're causing a lot more cost than if you just use 1 kilowatt hour. So we divide those up between those two drivers. And then we actually look, okay, well, who's doing the demanding and who is hooking up? And the commercial and industrial classes are doing most of the demanding relative to their size, as you would imagine. But the residential customers are the ones with the big customer count that are doing most of the hooking up itself. So we have different allocators for each of those groups. Of course, in the real cost of service, we use all the subdivisions of commercial and industrial, but for this example, we just divided up into residential, CNI, and lighting. Pretty easy a summary. Then we proportion that cost by those actual percentages. and then add up the amounts for each class and get the final amount. So you can see what that works out on a per customer basis is less for the residential than it is for the commercial industrials. And for the lighting, it's hard to summarize because our customers are a lot of different sizes and groups. So it's a municipality that has hundreds of lights and then HOA that has two lights. So the average gets a little wonky, but you can see there how that uses each of those aspects to try to ask who is causing the cost and therefore reduce the cost of service results. And this is this slide you can remember from last meeting of what that resulted this year, with a higher indication for the residential class and a lower indication for the CNI classes. And now the new material for this week is the question of, okay, now that we've done that analysis, we've understood what drives the cost, how do we actually balance all those factors and our principles that we also discussed last week? So we always start with the COSA. We want to be COSA aligned, and we want to always be getting closer to the COSA. But we also want there to be rate stability. We always also want the rates to be understandable to the customer. We also want to think about the future and what sort of glide path we're on for our future, not just our current, but also our future rates. And so that is how we actually produce the actual rate recommendation. So we start with our principles at that high level, alignment, but also gradualism, flexibility, the future, all those things. And what we've started with this year, and this is a trial year this time, is when we were discussing the whole budget process earlier in the year with workshops with the ELT and doing the initial construction of the cost of service, we set up a rate guidance and put some boundaries and things like, you know, we probably won't do any rate decreases. We'll just hold people at zero as the lowest rate change. If the COSA indicates a very high increase, we'll cap that. It may be, you know, depending on how high, 1.5 or 2 or 3 times the system average, and putting some boundaries around these. And from those, I produced a number of scenarios. I think we got up to scenario A through J for the leadership team to look at, starting there and then doing some more tweaks from there and getting feedback from what different people in the customer service department, in over our engineering, and certainly John as over the whole utility thinks about all of these things. And we landed on this as recommended adjustments for 2025, where the residential class does get somewhat above the system average, but about half of what the COSA indicated rate is. So the COSA indicated rate is a 10%, and this is a 5%. And then doing some tweaking with the other rate classes, again, to try to keep that kind of shape where those that are indicated for less increase get a less increase and a more increase get a more increase, but in a gradual kind of way, which would result in the changes in average bill shown on the second line here. So for the residential customers, we're looking at about a $6 increase per month. Any questions so far?
I love budgets, so I was reviewing the proposed budget. I may have misread something. Residential, here's 5.2 recommendation. But in the budget, it's 4.6. So is the 4.6 related to the system?
Yes.
System average.
Okay. All right. Got it. No, so that, I'm done.
That's the first column here on the screen.
Yeah.
You know, I got that.
Any questions?
So that brings us to the third stage of the rate setting and rate making process, which is if we have a percent increase, then we actually, how do you translate that into prices? Into units per kilowatt hour or per month or whatever other unit you're using in an actual price. And that's the question of rate design. And it's how do they eat the pie? We've set what we want their slice to be, but are they doing it monthly? Are they doing it on their usage? What are they doing? And this is important in a higher level and for our long-term goals, because we want to set up the customer classes so that the utility is as insulated as possible and as responsive as possible to changes in how customers use power. So the rates, and particularly the loads and the load forecast, is a little bit different from any other part of the utility and how it affects the utility's cost and operations, in that it affects both the cost and the revenue side. Most things, like say, inflation, as we were talking about, transformers and such, or regulations, they affect one side or the other. They affect expenses or they affect revenues. But your loads are a different kind of thing, where they're definitely can increase the expenses to serve them, but they're also what we're in business to do, to serve loads and to sell power. And that's how we get electricity, is by or get a revenue, is by selling power. That's the whole business model. And so if we get the pricing right, and if we get the pricing aligned so that for each, as each additional kilowatt hour is sold or not sold, the price we receive or don't receive is the same as the cost we spend or don't spend, the utility is very more stable. Has that stability is our revenue is naturally going up and down as our expenses go up and down. And the further we deviate from those cost drivers set in the cost of service, the more unstable it can be. And sudden changes in load can cause unexpected changes in revenue that don't match our expenses. And again, that's why we're always trying to get closer and closer to the cost of service, not just in the total amount of revenue collected, but even how it's collected as far as its rate drivers. As one of the ways that we've been trying to get closer and closer to COSA in the residential class, which is by far our largest class, is to implement a daily base charge for this group. And we've put that in a very measured way over the last few years. And we have come to the end of our first planned phase in. So back in 2020, before 2020 started, we had a plan to go forward that got delayed a few years. Now we've had our 2-year step in plan. And we're at a point where we can ask now, where do we want to go with this in the future? You can see we have had an improvement back in 2020. This was all a green block. It was all a variable charge and no fixed. And you can see we've now got fixed revenue under our current rate structure. And that's coming closer to our expense structure, but it's certainly not there yet. And we're not yet covering even our complete fixed, purely fixed amount to serve the residential customer class, forgetting our, not even thinking about the semi-fixed amounts that change more slowly. And so what we would like to bring forward for the commission's consideration is to put all of the proposed 5.2% rate increase here into the customer charge for these customers. And you can see on here on this slide what that would look like. The vast overwhelming majority of our customers are small or medium customers. So this would look like a 14 to 22% or 22 cent, not percent, cent increase in the daily charge. This has some nice features to it. It aligns better with the cost of service analysis, but it also has the nice feature of being a fixed amount for everyone. So regardless of your use or what kind of heat you use or all those kind of things, you're still just paying this flat fixed increase per month. Are there any questions or comments about that?
I'll wait till the this kind of was a flyby, but I'll wait till the end of the presentation.
Well, we are almost at the end of the presentation. We anticipated that you might have thoughts.
Just me.
Questions? Go ahead.
Well, I guess that
I'm not putting two and two together here. These are only dealing with our fixed costs, not the energy.
Well, we anticipate to keep the energy rate the same and implement just the entirety of the 5.2% increase by changing the customer charge.
All right, so then I get to slide. I mean, I know that there was a graduated program we were going to start, if you said 2020. So is this in addition, or does this roll into the...
We reached our graduated program targets. So here, yes, these changes here, starting with an 8 cents small fee and rolling up to a 36-cent fee, that was our graduated program. So we are now at the top of what we have already decided to have as our graduated program. And the question is, what do we do now? Now that we have finished phase one, and we have to think if there should be a phase two.
So I think the next slide, if your question is why all into the fixed rate, I think the next slide demonstrates, because we're still not where the actual expenses.
Yes. So under the current, like I said, top of the graduated program with the 36-cent small fixed charge, we're still only about halfway to what the COSA would indicate is the appropriate daily fixed charge. And so we're asking for your permission to make another stab at that by putting all of the rate increase in the fixed charge.
Well, fixed charge, but into the fixed.
Yeah, daily base charge. I'm sorry, there's base, fixed, and daily, and customer, and they all mean the same thing. Sorry.
And some of that is our own doing. I would ask you to reference our water rates, and we do have a customer charge. We term it customer charge on the water side. That is still quite a bit higher than what we are proposing as we bake in the full 5.2 increase into our fixed charge, or we call it a base charge on the electric side. That would still be significantly lower than our monthly customer charge on the water side. And that is, as Christina said very well, we are still trying to capture those fixed charges, our fixed charges, into a fixed monthly rate or the base charge, because that then starts to mitigate the variability or the vulnerability of our rates based on the ongoing expenses.
I get that. Yeah, I get that. But this is... So this is, again, a five-year forecast. I mean, it's going to graduate.
No, we were hoping to make these adjustments just for this year in one step, and then next year come back with a new recommendation based on next year's cost of service.
Okay.
One more point of reference. The last... To Christina and Peter, you may have to help me on this, but the last two rate increases, we did bake those into the fixed charge or base charge as well. As we were making those gradual increases in the fixed charge, and we had the revenue adjustments each of those years, we baked most, if not all, of that revenue adjustment into the fixed cost or the base charge.
Yeah, and if I recall, when we made increase because of Bonneville, we made that into the variable.
Yes, we did.
Although I argued that we should put it in the fixed because we weren't there yet.
Yeah,
but I understand the logic of the energy.
And that's why that energy chart has stayed pretty much pretty close to the same over the last 4 to 5 years.
Yeah.
Well, so thank you. I understand the COSA model, and I understand, I believe our utility's different, but I understand in an IOU world, I understand the logic of allocating all these costs. But to me, without the entire system, we wouldn't have a utility. So it concerns me that only the residential customers are paying for those extremities of the system. by the nature of that's where homes are really located. So it seems like, you know, 75, 80 years ago, the voters chose to purchase, to form the public utility and purchase the assets from an IOU so that all could enjoy the low-cost bond of power that we have available to us. And so I really believe that all customers benefit from the entire system. And I know that the allocation is such that rural customers are mostly residential, and so they bear that cost. I understand that logic. I'm not supportive of going beyond the 4.6 with the residential customers. I understand the logic. I also just don't think the 10% difference is that large. I am very supportive of continuing to add our increases to the fixed. So those are just how I feel.
Did you say you were fine with 4.6 for system?
Well, I guess that's a conversation as we finish out the budget.
Yeah.
Right now that looks like what's indicated. And so I'm uncomfortable going beyond the system number for the residential at this time.
You know, perhaps, and I'm sure we've had it before, but our next discussion on COSA and what that means and how that works in utility, it might be appropriate for us to have a more in-depth discussion on what COSA is and how that feeds rates and how those rates are assigned. Right, I mean, the percentages are assigned, because I think there's, and I believe COSA has some validity because the users that are causing the cost are the residential class.
I understand.
So you're saying by location that our rural customers would be different than our?
No, what I'm saying is our residential class is costly to cover.
Yes.
In part because they bear most of they probably bear a large part of the distribution system in the rural areas. The businesses typically are located in rural areas. And I'm saying without the entire system, we wouldn't even have a utility that gets to purchase preference power from Bonneville and help all ratepayers of all classes have less expensive power. So I understand the model. I don't need any extra training on it. I've actually read some on it.
I understand what you're saying.
And I also just don't think that the 10% difference is that substantial. So I'm completely supportive of us going through the COSA process every year, looking at the data, seeing if staff thinks we're making improvement or not. I think the nature of where new construction is, it's typically in apartments being built in urban centers. Those aren't going to be as expensive for customers. The mix may change, but.
And the only thing I would say, I understand your point, but for the small, maybe some sense the medium, but certainly the small commercial customers, you think about density of residential versus density of in the small grocery stores, the quick marts, the other small businesses, there's a proportion there, right? I mean, we have lots of customers, residential customers in Linwood. We also have a lot of businesses with Linwood. We have a less significant number of customers in Darrington. We have less significant customers, small commercial, medium commercial customers there as well. So, you know, I don't know that it's a flat subsidization, if you will, across those classes relative to where residential customers are located, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I guess the other thing is I think a 4.6% increase is a fairly large increase. And I understand the need for the revenue for the organization. So I guess that's the other thing is, to me, this is not the best year to try to make up the calculated difference in the COSA.
You're suggesting you have no fixed cost increase?
No, I was suggesting that we increase the fixed cost by 4.6%, if that's what we end up approving, that the system increasing the budget.
So you're good with the overall system 4.6, and that is relative to the budget?
Yeah.
You're thinking about the allocation to residential. Your proposal is a 4.6.
Not 5.2.
Yeah. Not 5.2. So then we would have to adjust the other rate classes to make up for that 6% difference, so that we can ultimately land at that revenue adjustment that the 4.6 represents. Mm-hmm. Overall,
we need the revenue to run the business. Yes. I was told I can't say subsidization anymore, but that's kind of where we're headed with this discussion.
Well,
one class would subsidize another class.
I guess it's been where we've at by these calculations ever since I've been on the utility. We're actually, I think, less than we were. Part of that is after all these years, going from a complete energy charge, no fixed cost, to having a fixed cost. So, you know, I think we've made vast improvements in this, but I still look at our residential customers, our owners. They are the voters. It was the voters that originally chose to form so the bonds could be sold, so we could buy the assets from Puget and form the utility, and for them to have a say in how their utilities run. So I think it's a little bit different. I understand the logic of Coast, and it's very personal logic.
So would it be the board's desire then for us to come back with an adjusted a rate adjustment across the different classes that reflects a 4.6% increase for residential?
Well, I'm just one commissioner, so if I'm the only one, I think the answer is no.
That's why I'm just asking for directions.
Yeah.
Well, we're getting close to approving the budget, and that would be a board policy discussion, would it not, if we would want to change? And I need a whole lot of information.
No.
We would want to change how we allocate.
It would basically be us coming back or bringing back some of the other options that we had built into the individual rate class adjustments. So as I think Christina had mentioned, we had, I think, ultimately like 12 or 15, and much of that was my fault trying to dial these in and putting more work on Christina and Peter's, but we have other options and we can build other options for the board to view.
Where's the money come?
Well, it's all coming out of the same pot. It's so, 4.6 is the system. So we would bring back options that show a 4.6% residential increase.
And how it impacts the other.
And then the impacts or what the rate revenue adjustments would be for each of the other rate classes.
No, we're talking about 4.6, which I support. But the reality is it's 5.2 with the residential costs.
Well, it depends on how we decide to allocate it. So if the other commissioners want to follow Commissioner Logan's recommendation, what I would do is I would do the math to reduce residential to 4.6 and then increase the other classes rate increase to make a system average of 4.6 based on the proportions of the revenue coming from each class and the numbers. And I could show you those numbers or whatever other, you know, adjustments you would wish to make. If we change one, it flows through to all. And so as staff and management, you know, we need your guidance of where you would like us to show you to change and how then we can show you how that flows through to the other classes.
I'm fine with that. However, we need to remember in the school districts, municipalities, they don't fall within the residential class.
Yeah,
so we're talking about if we shift increases for them too.
Yes, no, that's right. If we reduce the residential,
which I get very sensitive
about. Ultimately, this goes back to the board's philosophy or the philosophy that you want to adopt on getting to what we would consider parity from a COSA perspective across all grade classes. So if you reference, go back a few slides, if you would, Christina.
There.
Yeah. So these are the COSA results based on an extensive amount of work that Christina and Peter and team have done. And you can see the current percent difference from COSA for each of the rate classes. So,
and to Commissioner Olson's point, things like schools and municipality buildings would be either here in the general medium schedule 20 or the general small schedule 25.
Oh.
Municipalities also pay for lighting schedules as well.
So again, it would go back to the philosophy that you all want to deploy as a board regarding hitting to parity or the cost of service for each of the individual grade classes.
The other alternative, Commissioner, is we could, the calculation is 10.2. We're taking a bite out of, the proposal to take a bite out of it. We could also potentially take a smaller bite. I mean, I think, hasn't this issue existed forever?
This issue has,
as far as we know,
existed for a number of years. As if we will improve the situation relative to COSA as long as we keep the residential adjustment above system average, it will be closer to COSA than it is currently. So that was what we were hoping to do with the current adjustment. If you think this is too swift, then we can certainly come back with lower amounts, either at the system average or maybe a 4.9 or 4.8. I don't know what you would consider a good maximum.
I understand residential. I've always understood that. And I've done expensing to schools, schedule 25, municipalities, counties, and I can't remember others that would fall within that, I assume.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, very sensitive to perhaps them assuming more costs, more of the amount than their costs warrant.
Yes, that is
more of the rate increase or rate change than their actual costs more. So I think I agree with you, an opportunity perhaps to take a deeper dive or look at variations.
I guess a couple of things. First of all, these are big classes, so I don't know how schools specifically come out. Right, they're probably in the general small large.
So it depends on the size of the school. They'll either be a larger school will be in the general medium class, that's schedule 20, or a very small school or like a daycare or something like that would be in the general small schedule 25. A county building, again, a large county building will probably be in the general medium schedule 20. A little side building, an outbuilding, will be in the schedule 25.
Boss Commissioner Wolf.
What would we like them to come back with? The other thing that really weighs on me is we're not talking about a 1% system-wide rate increase or a 2%. We've talked about those in the past. And so part of it is just, it's hard for me to take this bite, which I don't completely believe in. I don't mistrust the calculation one bit, but in a year when we have such a large general rate increase. And so this is a problem that's been existed before my time on the commission.
Yeah.
It sort of gets kicked down the road. And I appreciate trying to get some clarity around it and figure out how we're going to look at this in the future. It's a difference that 10% is not a difference that bothers me. And I will say it looks like we've made improvement from the previous TOSA calculation. So it's not like we're going backwards. So I guess I'm as a compromise, I'm comfortable with taking a smaller bite. Maybe 4.8 for residential. If I had a magic wand, I would give nonprofits like schools a discounted rate. I would give our customers discounted rates, and I would charge commercial organizations, big box stores, and those kinds of things a higher rate, because it gets back to that fundamental of why we exist and how we exist. And in that model, these big box stores get our low cost power because the voters many years ago decided to form this utility. If not, we would all be paying Puget Sound energy prices. That's what we bought the assets from.
Did you get any clarity on what we're asking?
No. Yes, I think the gist of it is bringing you back options. That where we have adjustments to the residential class, trying to stay closer to or on the 4.6, and what and showing what that adjustment will make across the other rate classes. So all I would ask you is focus on the current percent difference. So that's that 10.2 minus 8.6, that line. Philosophy for ultimately where the board wants to go towards cost of service across all rate classes. And we'll bring back options to try to meet whatever that philosophy is.
And, you know, one might say, I'm putting that customer hat on, that might be appropriate for the board to look at if we want to cut what's proposed for one class, residential. One might say, well, maybe we need to cut operations costs. I ain't supporting that.
But then
it could be, if you're not drawing the red, well, you're talking about them taking the difference and spreading it out over the other classes.
Yeah, this isn't going to change the actual cost of us delivering power to our customers. That's built into the budget. That's what equates that revenue adjustment at 4.6. This conversation is, how do you want to allocate those costs, or that revenue adjustment, I should say, across the rate classes based on where they are currently and whatever that philosophy is to get towards the cost of service.
Well, and I support that, Commissioner, taking another look at it with some variables. Do most utilities follow a strict cost of service and establishing their rates?
I'm asking that because I think there's one state
famously doesn't, but
that's
just my understanding.
Yeah, what I would say is give huge credit to, again, Peter and Christina, our subject matter experts who understand this world very, very well. And they have developed the cost of service for each of those rate classes. And that's where those costs are now currently allocated. Board's decision on where you want to take that information and allocate those costs, not just in the short term, but from a long-term or a strategic standpoint, where do you want those rate classes to be? I mean, ideally, we want, again, based on the work that Christina and Peter have done to identify the cost of service for each of the rate classes, ideally, customer-owned business, we want that to be at parity, or each rate class paying their fair share for the cost of service.
I really identify with your concerns about the residential customers. However, outside of Snohomish County, nationwide, if you want to do it very incrementally over time, I don't think our economy is going to improve. Not now. And inflation is predicted to go up. So I think we have to be careful not to cut ourselves short. And
that's a good observation.
I mean, I'm really concerned about the economy overall and how it's going to affect us. And I think that if we have to, as we say, face the music, we can't put it off. At least,
well, I guess I need to see the variables.
I would be interested.
I think what John offered is to come back to us
with
options.
Oh, yeah.
Is that
absolutely that always cool?
Options and impacts?
Yes.
always interested in how it might shift.
In our discussion, I hope that doesn't mean you guys are experts. And I don't want to send a message that you've done the job of a balanced look at it, a look at reality. And I appreciate that.
Thank you, Commissioner. I know that this is also part of the job as well, is getting feedback from our elected officials and incorporating it. So thank you for any feedback that you can give.
Yeah, I really appreciate the feedback and the guidance, and we'll bring back options that show the percentages and then also the actual average delta or bill impact. The other comment I want to make, you know, it's inflation and all the pressures that we've had that are really what's causing the revenue adjustments and the increases. The opportunity to make a bigger impact to get to parity is actually with years like this. If we have a smaller rate increase, say 2%, it's much harder to make up that gap,
right,
or that difference.
But if you front load it, and then you kind of reduce the possibility that that would occur, right?
Yeah, if we do it now, we won't have to do it later, if that's what you're saying. That is true.
I mean, the other thing is we're building a system where we're going to get a lot more data on this. Our meter installation is complete. We're going to have a lot better idea of different businesses with different residential customers, what those profile, what the taxes are actually costing them. We may be farther out of adjustment than this. I guess the other thing that would be helpful, and I don't know if we have it, but it'd be interesting to know over the last X number of years, how has this changed? Is it a smaller number than it was 5 years ago, the 10.2%, or is it a larger number? I don't know. Are we making improvement on it over a part of the time? I don't have the historical perspective, but I have the feeling that it's always been there.
Yeah, it has been there historically, yeah. And I will say we have made taken steps in the right direction over the last couple of years.
But the economy, COVID, whatever, has exacerbated the problem. But what we're struggling with is years before John got here of no rate increases when we should have.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And it built a mountain, and now we're trying to over time work our come out with a field here, flatten it out. So I believe that's what you were saying, right? Is that perhaps we weren't as realistic in our rate setting in the past.
I think what I less gladly said is it's been kicked down the road. The can has been kicked down the road for many years, Commissioner.
Good for you to be less polite than that.
And so I don't feel the need to take as big a bite this time. And I still don't completely, you know, I think we're a little bit of a special cause variation.
And that's a great conversation for the board to have. Ultimately, that is your call from a policy perspective and a strategic perspective as to where you want to go with the rate allocate or the cost allocations across rate classes. And again, we've got a fantastic team that can bring you all the data and all the information to help you make a well-informed decision.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we can't count on the economy being as good as it is now.
Oh, I think it may be worse. I think it may be more. I think so too. So we just.
Well, we have economists here.
I will say a couple of tenets to principles, right? We want to try to make rates as stable as possible. And that's, again, part of baking in the revenue adjustments, the rate increases into the fixed charge. That helps, especially in the long term, reduce some of that. So, you know, affordable, reliable, that's all part of the principles that we're trying to adhere to through this process.
Real quick before we proceed, can you just confirm the request is to come back at the next meeting with recommendations for the rate adjustment
options?
Options.
Yep.
How
Thank you.
A new alignment, maybe? Is that what we're talking
about? Yeah, there'll be options with the realignments of those. And I will say openly, I think it was my call to not bring you options. So this is 100% on me. I thought it was best to bring you a recommendation, one recommendation. So I'm happy to bring back the options for you all to have conversation around where you think is most appropriate. That, again, fits with your philosophy and your strategic plan from a race perspective.
And those options will look out to the future.
Yes.
We're pushing this out and what that means.
We can bring you what the trajectory would look like.
Yeah, because I don't want to look at 1 year.
Whatever we decide to do this year is going to push an issue out into future and years, and what's that impact?
Right, and if we look at the trajectory, it'd be nice to look at the history.
What's it?
Yes, we can certainly go back in the archives.
Go to the year 10 years we went without a rate increase with that seated board. Guess what?
The only issue with that, we can, but we don't understand what the philosophy was. We don't understand what the intent was, or even how we got to the allocations of costs across the different rate classes.
So last year's 10.5 is the last one. We're completely comfortable with it. Is that what I'm understanding?
Well, I think we have the data that will show past years, but I don't know what that, and we're happy to provide that.
Yeah,
I just don't know what that will tell you.
We
want to go forward.
We have better data from 2017 forward. Prior to prior to 2017, the record is more spotty. There doesn't seem to appear to have been a COSA performed in some of the years prior to 2017. So it's just spotty. We can tell you what we can find and what we know, but just a forewarning that there's some documents that just don't exist.
Yeah. I mean, part of this is we, a few years back, thought it was most prudent to do our due diligence from a cost of service perspective. And that's really what has led us here today, having made or taken your feedback from last year, timing of when we're doing the revenue adjustments relative to the budget. So we're trying to really become more effective, more efficient in how we align this with our budget, and also then align or make sure that we are following your guidance from a cost of service perspective and how those costs are allocated across all the different rate classes.
Thank you very much.
Any
questions?
This was very good work.
It was very good.
Thank you. Thank you. Have fun. I'll see you soon.
Okay.
Not that you didn't have enough.
John, let's take a short break before the next one. So it is now 10:09. Let's come back at 10:15. Did that work? It's 10:15 when we are back. Next, John.
Excellent.
Microphone is off, I believe.
Oh, thank you. So next up is the commercial and industrial time of day rate update and proposed extension. And Peter Dock, Don Holland.
Right. Good morning again. I'm back. Peter Nathauer, Senior Manager of Rates, Economics, Energy Risk Management. I also wanted to acknowledge Felicia Ng, our principal economist in the department, who contributed to this presentation. And Angelica Hodges McGill will be joining us. She's a program manager here at the district. She'll be talking a bit about the survey as part of this time of day pilot. So what we're talking about in this presentation is the commercial and industrial time of day rate update and proposed extension. So we have a bit of a two-part, give you some information on how it's going. And then the second part is to request that we extend this pilot for a year. that's the purpose of the presentation. Thing to add here is the motivation for this extension is that we would like to allow for an easier transition for the current pilot participants to the permanent CNI time of day rates, which we expect in 2025. We're not going to talk about it in this presentation here, but we'll be coming back to the board as soon as we can to bring that to you. So the expectation here is informational only. We're going to be coming back for approval on the extension in a subsequent meeting coming up here. Just a little timeline here. Last time we've talked about this was April 18th, 2023, where we provided a update and we proposed an extension that carried us through 2024. Today is the briefing. We'll have our open public hearing on the 3rd, and then we'll request your commission approval on the 17th of December. And these rates would be extending the pilot and the rates themselves starting in January. So our current pilot ends the end of 2024. And so this would go into effect in fact, January 1st through 2025, December.
Is this because you need new data from all the new meters? Is this because of the need for
the extension? Primarily related.
Is that what you're expecting? Is you'll have quite a bit more data to put into your calculations?
We will be getting more data, but I would say the primary purpose of this is to ease in the transition. There's a lot of effort that went into working with these particular customers, as I'll get into the presentation, and we would like to convert them over to the new time of day rate and to give that process itself, which takes time, ample time to do that effectively.
I see.
Yeah. But from a data perspective, although we'll get more data, I think we have sufficient data to come back to you with an update here. And I'm not sure if more data is going to change that recommendation that we're at. So probably lower value of the data. I can't believe I'm saying this, but probably lower value of the data than otherwise. That's the one time you've heard me say that, right, John? just quickly talk about
less robust. We'll call it less robust.
Less robust. We have sufficient data, so we'll make it robotic. So talk about the concept of time of day rates, how we got to this point, a little bit of history, and then look at some of the results from 2023, and then talk about the extension proposal. Just disambiguation, we have just finished the previous briefing, and that was on the revenue adjustment. And so we've had a couple of packages, the first one being revenue adjustment that we'll be continuing to talk about, the second one being the presentation here and the other presentation today on the permanent net billing rates. And so those will have separate timelines, but there's a lot of things happening with rates, as you can tell. That's why I'm here all day. First question, what is a time of day? Time of day rates, also known as a time of use rate in the industry, charges customers different prices at predetermined periods of peak and off-peak hours and predetermined prices during those periods. Time of day rates enable customer owners, meaning choice over their energy use, control over their bills, support for the smart investments that they might make in flexibility or changing behaviors, value for their contribution to the regional energy goals, because our prices that would be part of that time of day rate represent those costs of complying with those regional energy goals, and new engagement pathways for the PD. So there's a lot of value that we offer to customers through time of day rates. This is an example of what a time of day rate might look like. And this is similar to what we've had in our pilot for the Flex Energy pilot. We have, what you're looking at is a single day and a price on the y-axis there. And the gray bars are showing a flat energy rate. This is similar to what we have in Schedule 7. Any time of day, it's the same price. Doesn't matter if you consume energy during our peak periods or during the off-peak periods or at any particular hour. The time of day rate is overlaid on top of those gray bars with the blue bars. And you can see three levels there, three tiers. And those tiers have a structure with different times in the day, shown on the x-axis. So in this one, we see two peaking periods, and you'll notice that the peaking periods have higher prices than normal. There's also what's called a shoulder or midday pricing period. And you can see in this example, the shoulder period is slightly lower than the gray bars. And so this is a slight discount versus the normal rate, right? And then also you see the off-peak periods. And these are during the evenings, and there is a significant discount versus the off, versus the standard rate. And so what we look for in these time of day rates is a sufficient on-peak to off-peak ratio, so that customers look at that and say, hey, this makes sense for me to do something. And pilots in the past have had issues with providing that sort of incentive for customers. And we also want to also see that when these rates are constructed, that they match what the actual costs are. So as you would expect, if I put our load shape behind this, superimpose that, you would see that our peaking periods and our peaking costs, which are the most expensive, are going to be coinciding with those peaking periods. And also lower costs are going to be coinciding with the off-peak periods. So like we've been talking today, it's another way to convey our costs to our customers, but actually give them a way to participate, engage, and incentivize these sort of flexible behaviors. Time of day rates are becoming more and more prevalent. Here's a map of the US, and you can see this is from 2022. All utilities are required to fill out a yearly survey, which talks about the number of customers and the rates they pay. And this is, so we can track how many customers are on time of day rates. And for a clarification, TDR, time dynamic rate, that includes both time of day rates, but also things like demand response and critical pricing, other sort of pricing options out there for customers. Looking at the states, California, Maryland, Arizona, Colorado, Missouri have some significant numbers of customers there. This was in 2022. We're going to see more in 2023 as we get more data on this, but it's becoming increasingly common nationally. Some of these programs that have really high percentages of their customers, Baltimore Gas and Electric, San Diego Gas and Electric, have made these programs either mandatory or opt out, and for reasons of saving costs and also providing these incentives. So we can see in Washington State, Oregon, let's see, I think I've got a little pop out here. We've historically lagged versus our the peers in the country. Part of this is due to low costs overall, power cost to begin with. These things are changing over time. Also, the metering infrastructure hasn't been in place. So it's very difficult to do time of day without that metering infrastructure. But if we look around at our peers, things are changing fast, and we could do some name dropping, and I'm sure I will at some point. A lot of our peers are they've not done a pilot, are considering doing pilots, and are moving very quickly on time of day rates.
In Arizona, is that mostly a Salt River project?
Commissioner, can you move your
mouth? Oh,
your terminal, sir.
Sorry. Thank you. So in Arizona, is that Salt River project doing a lot of that?
SRP has been very active. They've been leaders with a lot of time of day rates and advanced rate designs, not just time of day, but others as well. The other one is the Arizona Public Service. You can see that they're actually on the list just by the number of customers, which is how this list was created. 61% of their customers are on a time of day or advanced rate design. Pretty impressive.
And SMUD, I'm amazed that SMUD is such a...
SMUD as well, as far as industry leaders and what they've been able to show on the effectiveness of their time of day rates and programs, they've moved to an opt-out. So for new customers connecting, they would opt out. They would automatically go into the time of day rate, and then they'd be able to choose to come out if they want. They are mandatory.
They what?
They're a mandatory time of day rate. So you have to be a time of day rate. And only a few, there's some select circumstances where you can't be. So, sorry about that.
I'm aware that they've done a huge amount of public education on this.
Absolutely.
Successful
programs.
Big percentage of their work.
Successful programs.
Selling it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Excuse me. Sorry. Did you have more to say?
No.
Yeah.
Keep in mind, too, that each of these utilities have a full AMI implementation, which enables non-day rates. Yeah. That's key infrastructure that you need to have in order to effectively implement this.
Gotcha.
Okay.
So, in any case, we'll say it's less abnormal to be considering time of day rates. This is one of the reasons why we've been looking at it too, because of all the advantages. And you know, we're no longer ahead of our peers. We're kind of moving at the same pace at this time. Although our pilots have been, you know, taken up by other utilities and used, I've been able to speak about them at various times. So I would say that they've been influential with kind of normalizing within the region, and now we're seeing the results of that. So specifically about our own time of day pilot here at the district, this was launched in 2020 and is currently active. Due to a manual process, the eligibility requirements were limited to large and medium general service customers. And it was a invite-only arrangement. So it was a manual billing process that we had to work through. So we, at this point, have 22 meters participating. About half of them are on the time of day rate, and half of them are on what we call rate comparison. So just to explain the terms here, we use the word opt-in in these slides. If a customer has decided to actually join the rate and are receiving the rate and their bills, and we use the word rate comparison to mean that they we simulate what it would be if they had that rate so that they can continue to evaluate over time. And in this pilot, they've been able to at various times choose to move over to the time of day should they see fit. So we've sort of allowed that opportunity for them to just observe or actually take the rate. So that's you'll see that language throughout. The actual structure you can see in the graphic there, this would be for the winter peaking period. And we did have a winter peaking only pilot here. There was nights and weekend discount. One thing to note is there was a 2-hour peaking window for the winter and a 3-hour evening peaking window. And this is a little different from Flex Energy where we had 3 and 3, but anyway, it's just a detail. And the arrows along the sides are what we're hoping those customers will do is they will take that energy in those periods and start shifting it out to the normal midday rate or the off-peak rates.
So are these customers still manual, or have they been able to take advantage of our Connect Up infrastructure?
They're still manually built, yeah, because it's not just the infrastructure, it's also the rate that has to be designed and sort of conveyed through a billing structure. And that work still needs to be done to automate that part of it. But that's the main reason. We do have interval data coming from these customers. Some of them we already had interval data, not necessarily the same system, but we installed MV90 meters for those that didn't have it.
Understanding that, you know, the backroom work on the accounting and all of that is pretty complex. And that's one of the reasons that
we
jumped into it.
We are over careful when it comes to designing those bills and conveying those bills so that we don't make mistakes, because they can be extremely frustrating for customers and, of course, frustrating for us. But from a customer perspective, it's very confusing. We never want that ever to happen. So. Our efforts in this area go back some time. So just pulling in from 2015, we participated in the BPA InterNOC Winter Demand Response Program. This was a BPA project that called some specific events, and Alderwood's Water and Wastewater District participated in that with us. We also had another pilot in 2019 through 2020, just right before we started the CNI time of day pilot. And this had some peak load shifting signals through weekdays. And we asked customers that were capable of at least 50 kilowatts of reduction. and they couldn't use some backup generation during those pilot hours. This all went into kind of our history of how we incentivize customers, and you know, just first asking the question, if we ask, can it be done? The answer has been resoundingly yes here, and I'll show you some more data here. I mentioned 22 meters. This is a breakdown of by industry type, whether or not they're in the opt-in. That means they're actually getting the rate, or rate comparison, or they're kind of getting the shadow rate that they can look at.
Was pleased to see in our ag grower. Wasn't that a difficult one to get in the program, or did they approach it? I'm surprised.
I can't really say whether or not it was difficult. We were definitely successful, right? And I think in some cases, if you look at whether or not it made sense for them, in this case here, recollecting some of the data, is that some customers are just going to win whether or not they do anything. In the case of indoor ag, you know, when you're thinking about when you are operating lights, that cycle, it's a very cyclical type of energy use pattern, right? And so if you look at that against the time of day rates, and if you can put most of the generation in the off peak, then it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
No, so I think that was kind of the motivating thing, is when you looked at those cycles, it made sense. And this is a sample of some of the information that we provide customers on a monthly basis. This is called our Mars report, a segment of it. But what you can see is that we give a clear indication of what the impact is on the left-hand side, and it's cut in half. So we look in the past and we say, okay, here's how you've done so far in the last 6 months. But here's also a forecast. So this uses last year's data, right, to kind of populate this, to give you an idea of what is gonna happen in the future. As you can see, with this seasonal rate, November, December, January, February, this is the period where there's a peak price. And so you're going to pay more during those periods, right? And if you only look at that, you'll say, hey, that was $669 more than I would have paid. I don't think this is good for me. What we're really trying to get customers to do is think about it from an annual perspective, because that's when they're going to save the money and sort of forecast on that scale. So you can see that down at the second lowest number there on the bottom, the 2,219. This is what we expect the customer to actually come out with. Take any individual month, you're going to get a little bit of a misrepresentation of whether or not it's a win for you or not.
This is an average, right?
This was one that we developed from the customer's Mars report at some point.
One customer
here, yeah. Okay, not going to pivot here to a little bit of the 2023 update. Excuse me, that should say 2024 is when we've gotten this data. But looking at 2023, when we look at these graphs, I just want to say I'm going to go through these pretty quick. I might skip actually one or two unless there's some detailed questions that you'd like. What we do is we develop a control against, compare that against the actual usage, right? The control is really important because that tells us whether or not we think the customer shifted as a result of the prices that we provide here in the time of day rate. But it could also be due to other factors going on, some things that we can't explain within our models, right? So a customer could just be changing their controls or changing their processes naturally. And as a result, this would show up in some of the data. This is the best we can do in this situation because unfortunately, we only have so many indoor ag customers, so many wastewater districts, and they're very idiosyncratic, right? And so this is what we can use for it. That's what we do. When we do build those controls, we compare things like weekday versus weekend versus holiday. We look at light consumption days and light temperature days, and then we draw that line and say, this is what we think it would have been had the pricing incentive not been there.
Okay, so a lot going on here, and this is, we're going to see a few of these, so I'll spend a minute to just kind of explain some of the graphs here. What we're showing is load profiles on average over the course of an average day between 2021 and 2023. And each one of those individual graphs are different months that we see there. January, February, November, December. Those are the months which have the peaking period where we want customers to move out of the peaking hours in their consumption. And we see a couple of lines on there. The blue line is the control that was drawn. The green line or the orange line are different colors, but those would be the measured values of the customers throughout that same period. We show it orange and green because a customer could be on rate comparison, and we still look at that because they might still be trying to change their processes, even though they're not actually receiving the rates on their bills. The green line is they are receiving the rates on their bills. So this particular one that we're looking at is a municipal building that opted in January 2021. And they began seeing some significant shifting late in 2022. This is an example of a customer that has successfully shifted. And so when we look at 2023, they've been able to shift out of their peak period by about 25%. In this case, the bill savings is about $4,800, 3.1% on their bill. You can see it pretty clearly in January and February. But just generally looking at the sort of shape, don't even look at the details of it, see how flat that green line is versus the blue line. That's fantastic. That's what we want to see. That helps us with our costs, and that's why we can convey it to customers. This is another example of flood control district. In this particular case in 2021, this was a customer that was already shifting out of the peak periods. See that. When we compare it to 2023, however, we see a even more successful shifting. So they were, the number 200% is really because there were small numbers to begin with. But look at November and February, right? 2023. That is a fantastic response to the price signals that we're giving. We were able to provide a 3,600. Let me take a moment here to get my numbers right. $3,600 bill savings in 2023, which was about 7.2% for them. Then we get an example of a mid-peak to off-peak shift. This was a manufacturing customer. And what we can see here is that the shifting here into the off-peak, they did do some shifting in the off-peak, which allowed them to take advantage of that rate discount. And so perhaps a little bit less so in the peaking periods, but certainly in the off-peak periods. Now, it's a little confusing with the coloring that's showing up on our screen here, but the March through October highlights in the graphs there are just indicative. There was no peaking period there, right? And there's only in the November through February periods. Another example, another manufacturing customer here, showing how they were able to shift in the off-peak periods, taking advantage of that rate discount. This was about a 3% shift, bill savings, $7,200, about 2%. So this is modest, but $7,200 is $7,200, right? In this case, we also find some customers that we would call just structural winners. They decided to join this, and they didn't really shift too much, relatively little shape to their change to their load profile. They have a pretty flat profile to begin with. And just because of their shape, they're gonna win here. We know that they did some shifting, but $28,000 is a significant number for them. 3.1%. And so what this shows us is even though they didn't shift a lot, what we are doing is conveying our costs to them in a way that is more reflective of what their actual costs are, right? And so they cost us less, and we can provide them some savings as a result of that. So even without any shifting, this is a good outcome because of that reason. This is another example. Again, we see this one. Won't dive into this. This manufacturing customer, but they saved about $8,000 with relatively limited shifting here. And then I also wanted to point out a couple more that are still working out the kinks, right, on how to respond to this. And this is one of our learnings, is that it's going to take some time for some customers, especially larger businesses, to respond to price signals, and we need to be aware of that and support them. So this customer is a transit customer, opted in January 2021. They have a low morning peak, very little evening. low morning peak, but they do have an evening peak. And what we can see is that they are shifting out of the peaking period here and we're able to save $800 in 2023. But you can still see some challenges with trying to sort of tune that to the right spot, actually getting the off peak, and they're still hitting some of the peaking period here. Finally, a customer in the health industry, where this is a not complete year of data, but what we can show is that the peak periods haven't been avoided here. And in this case, there was a bill increase. They were on a rate comparison only, so they weren't actually getting a bill increase, but they would have had they decided to use the time of day rate with this amount of data here. So they were shifting some of the morning peak here, but the evening peak didn't really change much. In any case, they weren't really able to shift too much out of that, those peaking periods. And so we would project about a $5,000 bill increase here. So this is a customer we would probably say, probably not for you. Or if you think you can do something, what can you do to kind of shift out of those periods, right? So it's still learning, even though it's not the bill outcome we would have liked here. So for 2023, now what we've done is we've added all those customers and kind of showed the percentage shifting that we saw. And we're looking for positive numbers here. And then also we have shown the bill savings in 2023. Again, positive numbers in savings, negative numbers are increases. Some customers are on rate comparison. We have bill guarantees as well. And so this would be a summary for 2023.
Do you know the total for that?
I can't tell you off the top of my head, unfortunately.
Okay.
I can calculate it, but.
Let me ask another question. So since we're all things COSA earlier today. So this is the saving we realize. What is the savings that we realize, and how does that compare to the savings that we realize?
Yeah, so it's a bit of a two-step process. Our COSA changes every year, right? And so when we come back next year and we look at our cost savings, we do the functionalization, we do the allocation, the classification allocation, right? For time of day customers, it would be part of another rate class. That's how this would work. And so we would load in costs of those customers in those time of day rates versus what they might otherwise be. So think of Schedule 20. Schedule 20 time of day, right? And so we would start seeing those impact the cost of service, which would then go into the way we would adjust our rates. And we would definitely see some splitting of what the costs are between those two classes over time. Something that, other utilities who have these time of day rates, they have to deal with too, is that, when we get more data, when we have more customer classes, that we can allocate that data more directly, we start having to handle more different rate classes in the COSA and make those decisions on, just like we're talking this morning, how far off they are versus the parity. Yeah. So, one good thing I will mention, and maybe this is just a preview for you to think about in the future, is that when we offer a new rate, we can offer that rate with some of those corrected values to begin with. And so we are probably going to be a lot closer to our COSA when we begin with new time and day rates. Another thing also to mention is that just by nature of the more complexity that we have with the time of day rates, because we have a peak, an off peak, we have a mid peak, we can allocate those costs more effectively instead of having these sort of broad numbers. It helps us to keep us sort of closer to our COSA over time and avoid kind of the thing where it drifts off and then we're sort of out of alignment just by nature of that complexity. But of course, it comes at the cost of being more complex. And we have to explain that to customers and educate and work with them. That was probably twice the answer you're looking for.
No, that's what I'm trying to understand. Thank you.
Okay, I'm going to ask colleague Angelica to tell us a little bit about the customer feedback that we've gotten.
Good morning.
So last winter or earlier this year, I was with the support of Peter and our key accounts managers who work directly with these businesses. I was able to develop a survey for these pilot participants, really to gather their feedback on their experience throughout this pilot thus far, as well as to identify any opportunities for us to help guide our future permanent time of day rate offerings. And so of the survey respondents, the majority of the participants did prefer the time of day rate. And we actually had two of our participants within this survey request to amend their participation from that rate comparison only structure over to the opt-in pilot rate itself. And then every single respondent did say that they would recommend this pilot to other businesses as well. Some of the pilot participants did mention that they faced challenges being a part of the pilot with things such as their work practices or programming, but with observation and over time, that capability to shift their usage out of those peak periods did improve. As Peter mentioned, with several of the businesses, some of them were able to benefit without any specific coordinated or planned efforts to shift their energy. They found that the pilot had been helpful for communicating to their internal teams as well as for future planning. And we do have the feedback from one of our customers here that said that it brought awareness to how they were using their energy currently, and then how they were able to use that information to communicate with their internal business partners. Our participants that were opt-in were very appreciative of the savings that they received, even when that savings was modest for them. And then a few participants did mention that having more access to data analytical tools would be a bonus or a plus for them. And then a couple other pieces of feedback from our customers. When it came to that peak incentive or reducing the cost of their energy bill, they mentioned that it had helped them to find creative ways to reduce or shift that energy, having that incentive. And then in terms of changes that were made, multiple participants mentioned that they were able to set their controls so that they could avoid those peaks. And one particular customer said, unless overridden due to high water or flood, they said that it was a no-brainer for them to participate in the pilot. Any questions on feedback from customers?
The future, this is the future, and given our shift in the Bonneville product, using less kilowatts will be a great benefit for us, correct?
always using
but in general, given the way that new contract, that new product.
Anyway, I like it a lot.
Well, Charleston, did you have a question for us? Or?
Well, I was just mouthing.
Well, to tag on to her sort of question, does changing to load following, does that change our cost at peak times or at non-peak times relative? Does it get more exacerbated or?
Absolutely. Yeah, it changes our cost structure. I would say that, you know, what I've heard Garrison Morrow, senior manager of power supply, mention is that, you know, when we forecast out what our rates or revenue adjustments in the future would need to be, it's something like a 1% less by going to load following, which is pretty significant. You know, we'd be talking about 5.6% instead of 4.6% in the following years and so forth. And so, but the structure of it matters, right? We're not looking at purchasing from the market, but we are purchasing from BPA, right? And their demand charges, their shaping charges, all of those things are going to be our costs, right? And if they decide to change prices, impact us too. So what we're doing with the time of day rates with respect to that is we've already looked at the benefits, the cost benefit comparison before and after. And we're going to be thinking about what the scenarios are that we can consider time of day rates, as well as other rates, you know, and other sort of kind of strategic questions like opt-in, opt-out, so forth. All of those things we're always going to be looking at. You know, we also have to balance, of course, what we can do, what customers are ready for, and your own input to that on what our policy is and where we want to go. So what we're going to try and do is, you know, provide a sort of a framework for thinking about that question, because this is one of those questions, like many rates questions, is there's a blank canvas in front of us, maybe with a little bit of sketching on it. How are we going to draw out the rest of that canvas? We have a lot of choices that we could do, and we have to, you know, work through that together.
I don't think that got to my question completely. So do we think that the difference between peak and off-peak is going to be greater in the future or smaller in the future?
In terms of prices or in terms of our loads or what?
Prices that we'll be purchasing.
I think we're going to have less variability. Less variability. So I think so. We're not going to see, you know, $1,000 per megawatt hour pricing.
No, I understand that.
Peak prices, which get brought in and sort of allocated to our peaking costs, right?
Okay.
And on the whole, I think it will be less volatile and likely lower. But we shall see, right? We also only know what we've seen in the past. And in the future, if the markets change, then we might say, oh, well, that the markets were really muted for the next 5 years. That's the sort of,
Right. It looks like Jason might have something.
Jason Tyskowski, Chief Energy Resource Officer. I'm sure I have a ton to add, but I will say, kind of just piling on to Peter's comments, it's going to be more predictable in the future. We'll know what the cost is, you know, at those peak times and, you know, based on our demand, know what that cost would be. In the past, there was a lot of different things that would factor into that. How much length do we have? You know, can we ramp up Jackson or other resources to help cover in that peak? What can we do with the slice product to help cover in a peak? Those sorts of things. Or, you know, do we have to go to the market? What's the price in the market? Now we're going to know, you know, what is the cost for that demand charge from DPA, and what the billing determinants can figure out what that will be.
And I think the likelihood of resource adequacy, more concerns with resource adequacy lessening rather than worsening is not practical. I mean, as we've talked about often, further electrification, EV, data centers, load growth is going up, availability of batchable load following resources, clean resources, are stagnant. So anything we can do to reduce our peak is benefit to us and our customers in a big way, whether it's a slice product or load following. I mean, we want to stay out of tier two pricing. That's significant. We may not have as much exposure going with load following, but there is still exposure. Reducing our peak is a significant way for us to keep our costs down.
Good question.
Just a couple more slides really quick. So just to kind of wrap things up, the narrative around the results are we've had some varied results from customers, as I showed, kind of four different categories. And put it into that box, I would say the dark blue is ones we want to see successful peak shifting. However, the sort of teal boxes are peak to mid-peak shifting and a little shifting, but savings. Those are also not bad outcomes. Outcome for the customer, which is little shifting, but potential bill increases, is a negative outcome. The way we sort that out is through education, working with our customers, and allowing them to have an opt-in program. I will say that even if we look at that box from a cost perspective, customers paying more because of their own costs being higher, from the utility perspective, I would say that that is not necessarily a bad outcome. However, we do need to be aware that that is a customer of ours, and we want to try and avoid that if we can mitigate that as much as possible. But as a result, we see no general red flags here. We do know that participants need tools to help them make those operational changes, and that takes time, and we can support them with decision-making. So what we'd like to do is ask for an extension here while we're designing a permanent time of day rate. As I said at the start, this is mainly to do with continuity of the existing participants. We want to make sure that those that have committed to joining a time of day rate, we can offer that and transition them over successfully with the information that we can provide them. And we're looking for that extension to go into the end of 2025, giving them more time to review, compare, and decide whether or not to move to the new time of day. I think that's it.
Questions, commissioners?
I don't have any.
No. I have none. Oh, I do have one. So
I have a comment that is off topic.
Well, this is not off topic, the time of day, Rave. So Commissioner Wolf and I attended the PNUC annual meeting, and the keynote speaker talked about many things, including time of use rates, and she emphasized focusing on what a customer wants, not what the customer gets. And she used an example of a customer, and she said, well, have you tried this rate? And the customer said, you mean the one I save $5 a month, and then I have to turn off my air conditioner when it gets really hot outside? Yeah, I'm not going to do that. So it's just an interesting challenge for us. And I know we've worked on this a lot, is to really focus on what the customer wants, not just what may or may not benefit them. So.
Right. Yep. Well, we're intending to, come back with a larger presentation about what we like to recommend for time of day rates, and part of that will include an implementation plan that discusses things like messaging and how we sort of reach out to the customer in the way that they're hearing use our time effectively for that. We try to recruit, but I think that's a great point. Is customers have different preferences and time of day rates and flex energy. This is one of the big learnings, is that we can't just assume one customer's like the next. I mean, we don't, but it's worth saying out loud and saying it again and again, that we have customers that might prefer to take more behaviors to save money. And we have customers that wouldn't change for anything, right? We've got everything in between. So we need to offer rates that reach out to what matters to them and also reflect our costs. So that's kind of where our starting point is. And I guess that's the preview for what's to come. But I think if you look at our organization and our commitment to customer experience. We're 100% behind that. And so whatever we offer is going to be based off of how do we maximize customer experience.
Look forward to it.
Me too.
Excellent. Well, Peter, you don't need to sit down. Come on. One more.
Right.
It's permanent.
This is your day.
Ready for COVID. Yeah, it's not Peter. Peter show.
It kind of reminds me of yesterday, the day before, in my world. Been talking about this a lot, but this is another exciting one. So I'll just do the introductions. Peter Dauenhauer, Senior Manager of Rates, Economics, Energy Risk Management. Also, again, going to acknowledge contributions by Felicia Nang, Principal Economist in our department, who has snuck in and is going to be correcting me if I make any mistakes on this one. Thank you for the data work on both of these. Our last presentation on this subject was in November 2023, at the end of the year. So we are again at the end of the year, nearly a year later, and talking about permanent net billing rate proposal this time. So the purpose is to provide some background information about the pilot that we've had, review the performance, and then we're recommending this time that we convert this to a permanent rate offering rather than a pilot. This meeting is informational only. We're going to be coming back with a request for approval of that. And this slide really tells us kind of some of the history. So I'll go through this, but also just mention kind of the what's happening behind the scenes here, right? Is March 2019, we adopted the pilot small distributed generation rate schedule, also known as net billing. We then had a pilot extension 2021, well, think COVID, 2022, COVID. In 2023, we're ending COVID, but we didn't have at that time enough data. We only had two customers at the moment. We wanted to just keep continuing to gather data at that point. So that's to your point, Commissioner Wolf there. And we're now in 2024, where we've extended this for 3 years, and are suggesting that we move to a permanent rate because of several reasons, which I'll talk about in the presentation. Therefore, a couple of weeks, we'd be coming back with an open public hearing and request the commission approval in 4 weeks from now.
Excuse me, what did you say? DG rate schedules, also known as what?
Net billing.
Oh, net billing.
Yeah, that's why we've titled this meeting net billing instead of that, just for clarity. But that is the same thing here. Okay. I will point out that these rates that we discuss here would go into effect in January 1st. So the rates that we currently have expire on December 31st. So we are a little bit down to the wire here, and appreciate the that fact, and I will always try to get these to you as soon as we can, but unfortunately this is the timing for this one.
Peter, I hate to do this to you, but I need to take a short break.
Absolutely.
So it is 11:06. Let's come back at 11:11.
All right.
Please continue, Peter.
All right, thank you. So to continue, we are looking for these rates to be effective January 1st. Current rates expire at the end of the year. All right, so we'll talk a little bit about the pilot of the small renewables net billing pilot, and then talk about the background on it, look at the performance to date, and then make our recommendation, talk next steps. I kind of already discussed this a little bit, but just want to recall for everyone that we also have a small renewables program, something different. This applies to distributed generation that has a range of over 100 kilowatt nameplate AC to up to 2 megawatts. And this is a power purchase agreement. It gets renewed, that can be renewed every 1 to 5 years. And in that construct, the customer produced energy is purchased by the PD. And we have a manual process that's quite customized. The customer distributed generation system is electrically separated from that customer load. With the pilot small distributed generation schedule, otherwise known as net billing, we adopted that in 2019. We had some limited availability because of the manual billing process, but we set pricing for any sort of customer generation that flowed onto the district. And the generation would be electrically connected to the customer load behind the meter. So I'll show you the metering arrangement in a second. And then we've had 1 year extensions, as I've said. And what this has effectively done is we've extended it over time, obviously, but we've also increased the eligibility. At the start, we said, okay, this was only for 501c3s. And we said, okay, well, now others can join too. And we've continuously updated the pricing to reflect market conditions. And we can see that in the sort of historical pricing. And the pilot goals were to address solar customers, in particular over 100 kW, that desired to net their consumption with their generation. It helped us remain fiscally balanced and test a net billing model. It enhances our district forward-looking community-based solutions. Again, this started out as a 501c3 only thing. We also wanted to research mid-sized distributed generation solutions, get data collection, do the analysis on it. And it would simplify the district's interconnection process for this range of 100 to 200, which is a pretty important range. Once you get past 200, you get further, you got to think about things like land, and this becomes more and more difficult. But this range is just outside the net metering range. And so there's a good swath of potential eligibility there. And at the start, again, enhancing low-income community support. As far as the metering arrangement, you can see that there is a production meter and then there is a bi-directional meter. And so we do some calculation to determine the in and out of what happens there to actually convey that that value to customer bills.
Just a point of clarification. Is the less than 100 kilowatt, is that the state set amount?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Required for this.
Yes.
Thank you, okay.
Current participants, HopeWorks and Berkshire Housing or Catholic Housing Services have been on the pilot for some time. Both of these are low-income, low-barrier apartments and have some commercial spaces or common areas. These are both scaled to just about 200 kW, right under the limits. In the last year, we've also been able to recruit Northwest Motors, a Volvo dealership. You can see the picture there in the bottom right. It's a 156 kW solar PV system. We've had a look at some of the load shapes and production. So this is for the first two. I'm not sure which is which on this, but in any case, we've anonymized it at this point. We can see solar production for this customer definitely showing up. This is an average solar production shape. This is top left yellow curve that you see there. We can see the consumption shape and then the net load shape where that just really gets carved out of that middle bit there where the solar production is high. And over time on the graphs on the bottom, we can see the delivered power versus the production that occurs by month or the year. So we're seeing, you know, kind of what we would expect, production offsetting the consumption and reducing, in this case, the peak load, which was for them in the middle of the day. Same thing for second customer here. I'd say very similar outcome. The net load shape is even more aggressively addressed during the middle hours of the day, but otherwise a pretty flat shape to begin with. So we are definitely gathering this data and seeing that it is achieving some production. Now, different times of year, you can see, I'll point out here, as you would expect during the summer hours, June, July, August, September, those yellow bars are higher than the orange, or I should say the purple or blue behind it, right? And that's those are the periods where pushing onto our system and we're paying them for that power and they're getting value from them. And this shows also the billing outcomes over time as well. So for these three customers, not equally, but all together, they've had a bill credits over $50,000 over the pilot period, which starts at 2019 on the bottom left, and that goes all the way to October. It's the last reading there. And the heights of the bars really represent some of the pricing because the production is pretty much staying the same. Production and consumption is not changing a huge amount. So the pricing changing over time, 2023 and 2024, we've had relatively high prices for the last years. And also shows you when those bill credits are being conveyed, mostly during summertime hours. Very little bill credits during the wintertime hours because it is solar only here.
Could you please explain the colors to me on this chart?
Yeah, we left the colors out. I probably should have just said each one of those is a different customer.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
But we pulled out the names just to be a little bit anonymous.
Okay, so anyway, customer one, customer two. Okay.
There you go. That's it.
All right, no green.
Green until 2024, so you could probably guess who that might be based off of when I said the enrollment was.
A quick one. Paying for what they're generating, is that wholesale or retail?
So what it is it is a retail rate because it's part of net billing.
Okay.
So
I'm fine. I got my
answer. We don't convey our wholesale costs, our marginal costs at wholesale, because that would effectively be the day ahead or real time price or something like this.
Thank you.
And that is a good segue for this right here. So what I wanted to say, one thing on this slide here is this pilot has been overall positive for the customers, for us. We haven't seen any red flags again that would suggest that we shouldn't do this. It's a relatively simple redesign for conveying value from customer generation. And that's the thing is we actually do look at wholesale costs when we build this model to figure out what the rates are. But we don't convey those rates in hourly increments or like a real time rate. We convey it in a simplified way that's easy for a customer to understand and for us to implement in a rate design. And we adjust as prices and cost changes, right? So that means it's an easy on-ramp for customers, and the net billing as it is a great, it's great for solar only projects for conveying those types of costs. We're also seeing continuing interest, cabinet manufacturers interested in this construct as well. So our recommendation is then to convert this pilot program to a permanent rate offering. So because we're doing this and we've had changes, we have load following, I'm going to talk through kind of some of the ins and outs, the nuances of what this entails, but that's the overall recommendations. Let's move this to a permanent rate. Let's not do another extension. And in doing so, let's update our prices to reflect current market conditions. Still block slice for a little while, but we move to BPA tariff, right? And our latest planning assumptions. And when we look at net billing, let's continue to look at that as a complement to our other rate options. We've got net metering. We've got time of day rates coming up. And we've also got our power purchase agreements, the small renewables program. And so what we'd like to do is put all those together and make it easier for customer and for ourselves to say, where do I fit in and make sure that there's no potential gaming, right? So we want to make sure we convey to customers the value that they provide, but it doesn't make sense to try to get onto this one or that one for no good reason, only for actual, you know, cost-based reasons.
Okay. What would it be like for a solar person who has quite a bit of solar on his house? How does net metering work for that customer?
So net metering is, it has been adopted by the state, so we have to comply with the laws around net metering, right? And we and offer net metering to customers that are on other PED rates up to a certain threshold that was based off of a load, our loads at a certain year, a portion of our load in a certain year. I think it was in the 90s. And so for a customer that has up to 100 kilowatts of solar generation, they would be able to join net metering at that point. One stipulation of net metering is that on an annual basis, it gets the credits that you might accrue during the year, they get applied forward. So the credit you might accrue in the summertime, which is often what happens, goes to the next bill, right? So you're building up credits during the summer, and then you're drawing those credits down in the winter, typically. At the end of March, those credits get what's called zeroed out. And what this does is it makes sure that people don't oversize their system to take advantage of a real retail rate. And there's some sort of limits on that. And so that's effectively why that zeroing out happens. Now, when that, so the systems that get designed then should be designed to cover the annual net, the annual consumption. Otherwise, the excess credit is not worth anything at that point. But net billing isn't related to that, but it does exist there. So that's an offering for customers, and it makes a lot of sense for a lot of customers that have solar to go into net billing to take advantage of those rates. Did that answer your question, or?
Oh, I'm struggling with it a little bit.
You want to ask
it
again?
I think if I had solar, I'd be dealing with it, and then I would have a better grasp of it. But it's okay. I'll just. I'm not sure what I don't understand.
I think for this conversation, so those customers under 100,
right,
get by the state law, they get a pretty good deal. They get to offset their at our rates. And then this program is the optional program that we've been doing for those customers that are over 100, that we're not obligated to, but to help out.
That helps. Thank you.
So there's a kind of a clear delineation here, under 100, over 100, what the options are. And that's something that in the future, we wanted to change that. We wanted to offer net billing at a lower threshold. We could. We're not recommending it now.
Thank you.
Discussing some of the changes going forward. We need to make an adjustment, given the change to the BPA load following that happens us in October 2025. We go from block slice to load following. First of all, we've looked at the cost signals. Those have changed. To Commissioner Logan's point earlier in the day, they've changed, and we brought this into our cost calculations when we offer something to customers here in net billing. We also know that we can raise the eligibility prior to this point. This 100 to 199 kilowatt range was the limitation. Partly because of the additional effort to negotiate and figure out the integration fees with BPA for sizes that were greater than that. This will change. And so at this point in time, once we go on the load following, we think that we can raise that easily to 999 kW. The asterisk there that doesn't exist is that we will continue to look at this when we review our small renewables program. That still exists. It's an option for customers right now. And so what we want to do is, again, to make sure that when we put them all together, it makes sense from our standpoint, from a cost perspective, and it also these rates complement each other instead of, you know, conflict with each other. And so we might be coming back with some changes to net billing. We know what's going to happen with small renewables.
So what we're going to be asked to approve before the end of the year, is that going to still get the 200 cap, or are we expanding that?
So I'm going to skip forward and then I'll come back. Right now, it's for the existing cap. And then we're going to layer this in with the permanent rate so that in October, after that point, the cap will be automatically adjusted to the new cap.
Okay.
That was the intention.
Okay.
And it's not as elegant as I would have liked, However, we're going to be coming back with a rate adjustment next year, revenue adjustment next year. That'll be another opportunity for us to just kind of, you know, push away kind of the old adjustments and just have a single cap listing. Okay, so another little adjustment is that we want to transition the annual updates to April to March rather than January to December. So we don't have this sort of tight need to get this particular one done while all the rest of the rates are coming later. So it's just normalizing to our normal schedule. So this permanent rate will actually include 15 months to go from January to the next year, plus 3 months to get us to April. And we want to also be clear on, you know, how you transition from our published net billing rates to other rates and vice versa. And then we want to specify that we're going to be expecting to have 1 year price forecasts as we have updated on a yearly basis. However, if our costs are known more in advance, which is likely to be the case with load following, we're going to consider whether or not it makes sense to offer longer time price forecasts. So not a year, maybe 2 or 3 years or something like this. This is going to be dependent on what we know about our costs and how certain we are on that. But we have gotten the feedback from customers that they would like to see longer price forecasts so that they can plan for that. And if we can respond to that, then we will. Here's the mapping, and this is, I love doing maps. Hopefully this is helpful. If not, then sorry.
Yes, I've been sneaking ahead.
So this, you know, putting this together, again, how do we help customers and ourselves to make sure that we get them to the right place that's most beneficial to them and pays them for what they, their contribution there. And this is kind of what it's helping us do is, so we can start with a design perspective. A customer is designing a distributed resource. And the first question we answer is, is there a distributed resource with this customer? The answer is no. We put them on the standard rates. The answer is yes. Then the question is how big is it? That's the AC nameplate question. Less than 100 kilowatts, net metering. It's also worth saying that, you know, time of day at some point might be an option for some customers there, but under 100 kilowatts, that would be the choice. If it's over 100 kilowatts, then we get to this kind of sub question here, which is if it's before October 2025, then the range is 100 to 199. Exact after October 2025, it's 100 to 999. And you might be wondering, what's beyond 199 or 999? That's a small renewables power purchase agreement. Right? So there's another branch here that I simplified a little bit, but that would be the option. So if it fits within those ranges, then we say, is it solar only? And if it is, then they can use the published net billing prices because those prices are based off of a solar only production and solar only value. If it's not, then we would need to come back and use a custom net billing price or a time of day price when available. And so we don't have those developed yet. However, the three customers we do have on this pilot program are all solar only. And what we would do is we would develop and then publish those custom net billing prices should that occur. we also then need to monitor these customers too. And this is just thinking forward is that when a customer has solar only, then again, they can use those published net billing prices. And this, so we need a sort of periodic review of the customer generation. When they interconnect more generation or other items, for example, behind the meter storage, we know about that. At that point in time, we might come back and say, let's do a custom net billing price or a time of day when available. And that's because from the customer perspective, they will get more value from something else besides a solar only construct. And so we want to have that opportunity to give them the value that they produce. Think of a battery system, right? A battery system with a solar PV system as well. That battery system will allow them to have some flexibility, and they can now perhaps provide some shifting away from peak hours during the winter time, whereas a solar-only system is limited to what that solar shape is. So we need to have that way to convey that to them.
Solar only means they don't have any storage.
No storage or, you know.
Or any other sources of electricity.
Yep. So it could be, I think of a hybrid system that might include like a wind or hydro or combination. I mean, there's lots that someone can do. They could have hydro, solar, battery. Any sort of these variations like this would mean that their value proposition changes, and that would get us away from what we know to be the solar only value.
And where is the AC?
No, that's a alternating current. So,
AC, current, like AC.
Yeah, so it's worth,
okay,
just because we put it up here,
sorry.
Someone might review these slides and say, are you talking about AC or DC?
Yeah.
Solar customers, you know, are very, very, very aware of these things. And so we just want to make it clear.
No, I'm glad. I just.
Yeah, thanks for asking. All right, so introducing Schedule 201. I asked Christina to tell me what the appropriate number was, and she said 201. The net billing rate, this is what we would be calling it. This would use our financial model that I'll talk about in the next slides to capture the various marginal values of production that we have. And the rates are proposed or published only for solar-only customers. Non-solar-only customers would then need a custom net billing construct, as I've said, or time of day might be the shortcut to that. And we've also talked about a little bit about the timeline, but that's what you're seeing on the right-hand side there is starting January, we've got updated prices. We're keeping our 100 to 199 eligibility. The thing to point out here on this timeline, however, is that we are aware of the manual billing process, and this is something that is reflected here. We've got a manual process. We can only do this on a first-come, first-served basis until we automate that process, and that's something that we plan for 2025. So starting out, we're still restricted by that, and once we get to October, and our range changes, manual billing process doesn't quite change. We think by April 2026, we will then be able to implement that automated billing process. And then the floodgates are open to customers that have larger systems. And, you know, we're going to be updating prices accordingly from April 2026 onwards. So that's the kind of timeline of how those things would change and why we've kind of arranged it that way. The range has to do with BPA load following tariff, and then the manual billing process has to do with just the need for us to get that work done.
So that Volvo dealership, they're not solar only, are they?
Solar only.
They are?
Yeah.
Solar only.
So here is quite a bit of information here showing some of the history of the net billing prices over time in that big table there. I've highlighted the proposed rates going forward based off of these costs that we've seen. And the graph you see is a monthly view of the local solar pricing components. And so this is a non-seasonalized view of the same thing that you see in the prices. We've sort of flattened some of the prices so that it's fewer changes throughout the year. But the graphic there kind of shows you where the value is really coming from, and that is in July and August, September and October. And you can see where you know the different types of values that's being provided. We forecasted the energy market, so we looked at the heavy and light load shape for the generation, the solar shape, as it were, and we blended some of the prices we see from the market with the BPA cost that we expect to have at this time. We also include our local delivery savings, so when solar is being produced on the system, that reduces our local distribution, T&D distribution, and reduce some of our losses that we have. And so we've accounted for that, and we've provided the value that that entails. And then we've also included our on-peak credit based off of transmission and generation from BPA going forward. So we're all up to date here when we come up with these prices. And as you can see, the bottom two lines there are what it's come out to be.
Peter, can you talk about 2023 and 2024? Those are flat and they're dramatically different than the previous years and the proposed.
Driven by market prices.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's the short answer of it is we, you know, every time I've come with a risk report, I've talked about our forecasted prices, and we've seen elevated prices significantly through 2023 and 2024, where, you know, before that, if you look at, for example, 2019 through 2022, you can see much more muted prices. Has to do with the model bringing in and reflecting those market prices. As we're moving to BPA load following tariff, that's going to start going away, and we're going to start having more stable prices that are probably going to be, and we hope, lower. Our own costs will be lower. That does translate to what we can offer.
And I guess when these three customers signed up for this, they knew that there potentially could be volatility. What rate to offer them?
Yes.
Maybe an informed decision.
Well, we have conveyed that we can guarantee the year ahead, and we're going to update annually. And that gives us some flexibility, too. So imagine, we're in 2022, and we're not allowed to change our price. The value you can see in 2023 was much higher. And so we were able to convey that value to customers in that way. And so it does offer us some advantages, but for the customer perspective, it is more volatile. I think going forward, like I said, I'm hoping that we can offer a longer term forecast so we can have a little bit more certainty. One little bit of interesting math that we did just kind of considering what a 1.99 megawatt, that is 199 kW system, the value that might produce is shown here. We look at over 5 years under the circumstance that there's no self-consumption. So this is just the customer that only produces, doesn't have self-consumption. Now this is actually not what's happening, as we've seen. All these customers have self-consumption. But if it were the case, this kind of gives us a baseline to consider as it changes from year to year, right? We can do this calculation over and over. And so over time, you see the net present value of that production would be about $30,000. And assuming that all the market conditions and assumptions hold and so on and so forth for that, you can see where the value is coming from. A lot of value in the generation peaking credit around summertime, less so around the other parts of the year, but still significant peaking credit value offered. The energy value is less significant, but still something. I would say the second most. The other credits and other value is much, much less compared to those main sources. So that's really what's driving the value here.
So all these customers would have the same schedule for the solar they produce value.
The same schedule of production?
For each, yeah.
Pretty much, yeah.
But
because the sun affects everyone in the same.
Their costs are dependent on their own rate class, is that right? They may all be the same rate now, but they won't necessarily be in the future.
Yes, the costs are based off their whatever rate class they're in. Yep.
Thank you.
By the I guess the price they pay for the energy that they consume.
Right.
So that's the end of this presentation. As I said, we'll be coming back with a recommendation. That next step, so we'll be coming back to the request for approval.
Questions, Commissioner?
Oh, I should have asked this. On the assumption that all of the energy, all the solar energy produced, will be exported to the PUD.
Yes.
Why are you assuming no self-consumption?
Just for the sake of the calculation.
Oh,
because
okay.
If I assume, customer one or customer two, then I've got to sort of account for that.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Okay.
I have no further
questions. Okay. Only question is, again, since we were talking about COSA earlier, is this a par deal for the utility and the customer?
Say the question again.
Is it a par deal? Are we getting the same benefits? Are we both rewarded equally, the customer and the utility?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. I mean, we can't make any profit.
Yes,
and we can't even try. And so we're conveying what we believe is the true value of this production. And we're hoping that customers respond accordingly to that, but absolutely.
Anything else this morning, John?
Nope, that should do it. Great job, Peter.
All right, thank you, Peter.
Thanks.
Thank you for lasting.
Yes, endurance.
Yeah.
It is 11:44 a.m. and our meeting is recessed. The regular meeting will be here in the commission meeting room at 1:30 p.m.